Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Everyone here in the Zendo, so great to see you all. So great to practice here in the Zendo again. And we're hearing from people who are out there in Zoom land sitting with us that it helps to know that people and see that people are here practicing in the Zendo as well. So as we continue on, as we launch into the fall and start our practice period next week, it's really great that we are able to do it in this hybrid way. And we're getting people, new people. Thank you. Let me know if you can't hear in the back. New people learning how to ring bells and lead chants and be... we're having a Jisha, a teacher's attendant, again for the first time in many months. So it's like the whole structure is coming together again. And the structure of our practice helps us to hold upright when we're feeling wobbly and tentative. Stepping into that structure helps us do the practice. So we're grateful for it. And I'm stepping into the structure. It's my turn to take a talk today, to do a talk. And I wasn't very well prepared. I just put this together yesterday. I'm just going to share with you some things I've been reflecting on. Two big things, actually. Death and fear. You know, they're pretty much up at the top of the big question list. I've been thinking a lot about death lately, and I guess that's no wonder, considering that since the pandemic began, personally, both my parents have died at the age of 96 and 95, plus one beloved cat who was only middle-aged and came as a big surprise, so that was a sucker punch. Anybody who's had experienced the loss of a dear animal friend knows that there's something kind of unadulterated about that you just cry in a way that's, you know, it's you just grieve them in a way that's not as complicated as our human losses. I think many of you know that. Yeah, so our little cat as well. And then over the same span, you know, 4.55 million COVID deaths worldwide. 673,000 in the US, 27,000 in Canada, still counting. This is massive. It's not that pandemics haven't happened in the world before and mass starvation and disasters have been part of human life for as long as humans, you know, lived in large groups and mixed and spread illness. But it comes as a real, I guess we could say, wake-up call, humbling for our kind of contemporary, urban, prosperous, societies to be faced with this crisis, because you know, we like to think we have everything in hand, that technology will solve all our problems, but there are human problems to this situation that are not as easy to solve as inventing a vaccine or And there have been deaths of humans and plants and animals in what we call natural disasters of wildfires, floods, storms, earthquakes, along with our increasing knowledge of the role that our human consumption patterns are playing in the increasing intensity and frequency of these events. So I could obviously continue with this accounting, but it's not my purpose to be gloom and doomy. today, even though there are very grave causes for concern in our world today. At the very same time, there are people all over the world doing very important work, both at grassroots and international levels, for peace, human rights, environmental and climate issues, and the well-being of the plants and animals with whom we live on this earth and upon whom our lives depend. And this has been true throughout human history. Through the wars and plagues and disasters, there have been those who tended the sick and wounded, who rebuilt bridges and dwellings, who promoted peace and reconciliation. Can we count ourselves among them? If we are to do so, I think we need to become deeply acquainted with our fears. The early Buddhist texts mention a list of the five greatest fears we humans face. And the first, not surprisingly, is death. Then comes illness, losing one's mind, losing one's livelihood, and in fifth place, guess what? Some of you have heard this before. Public speaking. Even in the Buddha's day, 2,500 years ago, people dreaded public speaking. I think there's a deep kind of atavistic fear of performance anxiety, of being exposed in front of, publicly. Like, we're afraid the arrows are going to start coming at us, right? Or the tomatoes and rotten eggs. You're probably not afraid to sing in front of your cat or dog, but you might be in front of people, right? But going back to the fear of death, it's such a core fear for us human beings, probably since our very earliest awareness of it, before we were even quite human, because of course there are animals, some of the smartest animals, who have an awareness of death, elephants being one, crows being another. Have you ever watched crows gather or in this is another whole story I didn't plan on. When Michael and I lived in North Vancouver, Michael went out one day and there was a dead crow in the yard. And there were crows gathered around just cawing and making a big commotion. And Michael was going to take a shovel and bury the crow in the garden, but they started screaming even more. And so he set the shovel down, I might be telling this wrong, and talked to them and said, I'm going to respectfully bury your friend. And then did they quiet down?
Well, actually, I went back in the house.
First went back in the house.
And then I came out and I spoke with them.
Then, okay.
And it was fine.
And then they quieted down, and he buried the crow, and they kind of just stayed a little bit, and then they dispersed. There are lots of stories like that about crows. It's such a mystery. How can a being be so full of life, and then seconds later be so still? There is nothing like the stillness of death. What happened to that spark? Who knows? Who knows? Every human culture and spiritual tradition has attempted to answer that question and created stories and explanations around it. And probably every single one is inadequate to the true vastness. As my parents approached the end of their lives, I wondered if they were afraid of death. I saw each of them fear dependency, debility, loss of autonomy, even more than physical pain. My mom, after her second fall, she had two falls, head injuries, no longer remembered what she had lost. After the first, she really chafed against being in this nursing care room and not being able to cook and not being able to do the things that she always did. But after the second fall, she didn't remember those things. She also didn't remember her grievances with my dad. And a certain tenderness entered into their relationship that was not there before. And she lived 3 more years, mostly in a kind of vivid presence, with a sense of humor intact. Some of you have heard me tell of how I would sit with her looking out the window of her room, watching the wind in the trees, or butterflies in the flowers in the planter box, and how one day she said, "I'm just noticing the astonishment." And I said, "Yeah, me too." Me too. My father, on the other hand, kept his recliner chair turned away from the window. And I wondered, is it part of his turning away and saying goodbye to life? Well, if I can't be out there, I won't even look out. I wondered. He didn't have as good a view as she did. But he wanted his ancient desktop computer set up on a little desk in his room. I think he was the only one in nursing care that did. So that, you know, when he couldn't sleep at night, he'd get up and go on and check over the finances. And that was his way of feeling a sense of control, of autonomy, still, as his life seeped away. My mom was a lifelong Baptist, and yet she didn't seem confident in the afterlife. And I've talked to others whose parent or spouse or, you know, was a strong believer and yet fearful at the end of their lives. On my last visit to her, which was the fall before the pandemic began, we had this conversation. It was the night I was going to, before I left. And her memory had really, she'd really deteriorated in the 6 months before. And she asked me about my sister. I had a younger sister who died over 30 years ago of cancer in 1990. My mom said, "Sally's gone, isn't she?" I said, "Yes, she's been gone a long time." My mom said, "She disappeared." I said, "We all will sooner or later." And my mom said, "We had her for a while." And I said, "Yes, we had some good times." And then I asked her, "Do you think you'll see her someday again, one of these days?" And my mom said, "I think I'm going to go straight to hell." She didn't mince words. And I thought, you know, how strong that fear, you know, when you've been raised in a religion that threatens you with eternal damnation if you're bad. How strong that is, you know? And karmic retribution, you know? Those are the stories that we learn about, you know, what happens to us if we're bad. So I said, "No way, God wouldn't send you to hell." Here's me, you know, the Buddhist non-theist, telling my mom, "God wouldn't send you to hell." And then she said, "What's that other place?" I said, "Heaven." And I paused, I thought, it's not for me to promise my mom heaven. And so I said, here's what I said. I really don't know what it's like after we die. But I feel, not so much a matter of belief, but feel that we're always connected in ways that we cannot understand. We will always be connected. And I didn't say beyond space and time, because space and time aren't really what we think they are. I didn't say that. The great American poet Walt Whitman wrote, "All goes onward and outward, nothing collapses, and to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier." Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. That's Walt Whitman. How did he know that? Well, we can speculate that he served as a medic in the American Civil War. He bound the wounds of young men with no anesthetic, holding their hands as they cried out for their mothers. Walt Whitman had looked deeply into what we call in Zen the great matter of life and death. His service during the Civil War was a version of what the Buddha sent his monks out to do, to meditate in the charnel grounds and see the impermanence of human life. But Walt Whitman was also a hugely passionate lover of life. He saw, if you read his effusive poetry, he saw the beauty and energy of life everywhere, all around him, in all kinds of people. So maybe he could say, it is as lucky to be born as to die. So, musing on all this, I remembered when I used to train hospice volunteers, something from a book called Making Friends with Death, A Buddhist Guide to Encountering Mortality by Judith Leaf, who's a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner who worked in the field of death and dying. It's a good book. I really recommend it. And she made this list of what she calls strategies of hope and fear to describe the attitudes, different patterns of attitudes people have towards death, fearful and hopeful. So here, I'm just gonna read through these, and I just want you to kind of see which ones kind of resonate for you, which ones don't, which ones maybe you've observed in someone else you knew who was approaching their death. So under fear, seeing death as the great oblivion, you know, blankness, no consciousness, I'm gonna just be obliterated. Or the great insult, punishment. What did I do to deserve this? I remember people saying to me when I was a hospice counselor, my husband was a good man. He didn't deserve this. He didn't deserve to die, right? Well, who deserves, you know? But we feel that, right? We feel like we take it as a personal affront, death, whether it's ourselves or somebody we love, right? The great loss, taking away from us everything that we care about. The great departure, where we're leaving, going out into the lonesome valley. This is an old song. Jesus walked that lonesome valley. He had to walk it by himself. Nobody else could walk it for him. He had to walk it by it. Then it goes, you have to walk that lonesome valley. I could sing. I'm not going to sing it now. From my earlier days. The great interruption. You know, cutting off our plans. Well, I had all this to do and that to do. I planned this great retirement. And then on the hope side, there's the great rest, you know, freedom from the suffering and pain of this life, the great rest. Or the great answer, all will be revealed. There's another song, these are all old songs. We'll all understand it all by and by. I could be singing you these. gospel songs. All will be revealed. The great reward, right? Great, great, great heavenly reward. The great reunion, being reunited with loved ones, or with God, cosmic consciousness. The great completion, completing our time on earth. Can we feel that we have done that? Good question. That we've come what we came to do. So these are just all the different hopes and fears that come up around the question of death, right? And then I used to ask the hospice volunteers, trainees, to fill out their own version. What are your hopes? What are your fears? We used to also ask them to write, what would your ideal death be? And of course, we don't get our ideal death. We don't get to put in an order and say, no, I ordered this. Sorry. But many people say, I would like it to be quick and painless in my sleep. I don't want to be there. Woody Allen cracked, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there for it. Something like that. But of course, there's also value in time to prepare yourself and sit and be with you, spend that last time with your loved ones and look over the old photo albums as I did with my dad in May. And to make sure, as he did, that his affairs were in order, that was what he needed to do, right? Not leave a big mess for others to clean up, which I remind myself when I enter my room and the piles of books and papers are creating a hazard to movement. And I think, what if I die tomorrow? Somebody's got to deal with this. So I'm talking of death here because it is such a core fear for us humans, but really I want to extend the consideration to include those other big fears that we have. Fear, there's illness, injury, poverty, physical harm and brutality, humiliation and shame. We fear all those things, right? Even more if we've had previous experience of any of those things. Now, I personally am not afraid of bears or cougars, although I have a healthy respect for them, and we encounter them in our neighborhood out where we live in the hills above Mission. And I'm not afraid of spiders or mice or heights or the dark or flying. My greatest fears have always been of other people. Don't you think human beings are the scariest thing on this earth? Certainly, I think we're the most dangerous. And one of the reasons that we are dangerous, we human beings are dangerous, is we have a tendency to deny our fear, to kind of dissociate from our fear and divert or project it externally onto others who are different from us. We're afraid for our livelihood or our possessions or our beliefs, so we blame others who are different from us, who seem we perceive as posing a threat to me and mine, us and ours. We can see the sense of threat played out in so many ways in our world today. Who would have imagined 2 years ago that people would be so polarized about a life-saving vaccine? Would you have imagined that 2 years ago? In the face of a frightening new virus, a virus that behaves as viruses do, mutating into new forms, forcing us to keep adapting our strategies. It is so very human to grasp at certainty, at beliefs that will offer us a sense of rightness and security. The fear of someone terrified of COVID-19, so afraid to leave the house, and the fear of someone terrified of the vaccine are not so far apart. They might seem like poles, but they're not, but the fear is not, right? Both are rooted deeply in conditioned experiences, experience and beliefs. There are those, of course, who are particularly vulnerable to the virus through age or immune compromise. And there are also those who cannot take the vaccine, again, through allergic sensitivity or for whom it's actually not effective because their immune system is compromised. So again, it might seem like too extreme. Most of us navigate the way somewhere in the middle, right? In the middle ground. Some have welcomed the vaccines with relief. Some have overcome hesitancy in various ways. But don't we all hope we'll, sometime this coming year, that we will reach a point of so-called herd immunity so that we'll all be able to safely live and interact socially again and to practice together here in the Zendo? Maybe being a little more observant of sanitary precautions than we used to be during flu season, which may also turn out to be COVID season on an ongoing basis. Yeah. Even my speaking about the vaccine in this way puts me in the position of being perceived as being political, when as a Zen teacher I'm supposed to stick to the spiritual realm. But there are no such divisions in my life or in my heart. So I will speak this way and with, I hope, a heart of compassion for all those, any of those people who are in the grip of fear and confusion. These polarizations, the polarizations not only around COVID, but around throughout the world, break my heart. And if we are to live as bodhisattvas in this world, we must be prepared to be heartbroken every day. That's how open we must be. We humans don't take kindly to change and uncertainty. We don't take kindly to perceived threats to our sense of self and identity. And here's where deep insight into what the Buddha called the three marks of existence comes in. We could call them the Buddhist facts of life. One, anicca, the impermanence of all things. Two, anatta, no separate self, no self apart from the boundless web of interconnection. And three, dukkha, the suffering, the anguish, the discontent that results from our fundamental delusion about the other two. When we desire life to be other than it is. Insight into these facts of life comes when we simply pay attention to our lived experience, with a little help from the Dharma teachings and the Sangha practicing together. This practice of Zazen is simply a form, a structure, that supports us to slow down enough, to quiet body and mind enough, so that we can pay attention. It's not easy to stay steady in the face of our fears, because our fears live in our body in unpleasant ways, right? Ugh, I don't want to feel like this. Right? Sometimes we have to face our anger, our resentment, our envy, and scratch the surface, go a little deeper, and to connect to our fear. So it's often masked by some other outwardly projected emotion. It takes a certain courage to do this. Pema Chodron, the great American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, says in her book, The Places That Scare You, says this: the essence of bravery is being without self-deception. However, it's not so easy to take a straight look at what we do. Seeing ourselves clearly is initially uncomfortable and embarrassing. As we train in clarity and steadfastness, we see things we'd prefer to deny. Judgmentalness, pettiness, arrogance, I would add maybe cowardice, or self-protection of various kinds. And then she says, the more we get to know them, the more we get to... Oh, sorry. These are not sins, but temporary and workable habits of mind. Temporary and workable habits of mind. In other words, we don't need to identify with our horrible flaws, right? They're temporary and identifiable, workable habits of mind. And she says, the more we get to know them, the more they lose their power. This is how we come to trust that our basic nature is utterly simple, free of struggle between good and bad. So this is how our practice supports us to stay upright with an open heart and a supple mind in times of fear and uncertainty. When I asked myself what it was I wanted to communicate in this talk, this kind of little bit off the cuff, almost off the cuff talk that I just put together last night, I realized it's a kind of plea to say, if we are to find our way forward in these times, we must know our fears. We must look into their roots with patience and kindness and insight into the conditioned nature of our experience. We must take responsibility for our own reactivity and defensiveness, and be patient and kind with others' reactivity and defensiveness. See these as conditioned habit patterns, not identities. And that will help us not to project our fears on others, creating the mind of opposition and enmity. And we can cultivate an ethic of mutual care, even when it feels one-sided, even when it feels like it's not coming back to us, because that's harder, isn't it? And we can resist the narratives of polarization foisted upon us by social media, not only social media, mainstream media, and alternative media, and still stay upright, still communicate a life that is aligned with our best intentions. Offer our perspective from a place of open-heartedness and uprightness that's both strong and flexible, like a bamboo. Our practice gives us the capacity to make our way forward into the fall, into the unknown, the uncertain, employing skillful and compassionate means, not clinging to rigid stances, with patience and kindness towards ourselves and others when we're in the grip of fear. Because fear will arise, of course. Of course it will. Fear lives in our bodies. But we can see the conditioned nature of our fear, and we can respond to take care of ourselves. It's not like we want to ignore fear. But not blinding ourselves to the world around us and to others. Finding the common ground of our vulnerable humanity. I started out talking about fear of death, but when we really face our fear, it turns out to be just as much fear of life as fear of death, doesn't it? You know, fear that if we live our life fully, if we fully offer ourselves to life just as we are, you know, in all of all our warts and imperfections, that our offering will be rejected. So I think fear of life and fear of death are just two sides of the same coin. The great matter, the great koan of life and death, our great teacher. So is there any better time than now to wake up and pay attention to the great matter? So I'll leave you with those rambling reflections from my time recently. And I realize it's a little bit of a preamble to our practice period, because our practice period is going to be about being in relationship, being in right relationship, staying upright and open at the same time. Yeah, so we'll talk a lot more about that in the weeks to come and next weekend, along with all of you. So thank you for showing up today and for your kind attention. Let's chant. Unsurpassed, wrong one. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Can you put your books down? We'll stand up.